So we get a little metal strip, we place it under the flower, and then we pluck the metal strip and make it vibrate. So you're putting the sort of vibrating plate underneath the flower, getting the pollen out, and then moving to another pot and applying that pollen to that flower, and then shaking the stick again, getting some pollen out, going to another plant, putting that pollen on that flower, shaking it, getting pollen out. It's very, very time consuming. If we had little native bees in here, it would save us a huge amount of time, and they'd be far more effective at pollinating these plants than we'd be.
On RN, this is Off Track with Amanda Smith. In Tasmania today, with a relationship problem. It's between a shy and retiring plant called Susan and a discreet and solitary native bee. They can't get it together. In the wild, shy Susan will only give up her pollen to this bee, and the bee is playing hard to get. As a result, shy Susan is suffering and in decline. She's not altogether unloved, though. Matthew Crawford is meeting those who are working to secure the future of shy Susan and her bee.
This is a little shade frame. So this is a little corner of our nursery, part of the external collections rather than being in the glass houses.
All right, please meet James Wood. He's the Seed Bank Coordinator at the Tasmanian Seed Conservation Centre here at the Royal Tasmanian Botanical Gardens in Hobart.
So here are the Tetrathecia gunnii.
The other name for shy Susan, right?
Shy Susan, yes. Tetrathecia gunnii.
Just laid out on these benches under the shade cloth.
Just in front of us here. So it's a little small wiry shrub, small little leaves, little dark green leaves. You can see little pink bells hanging off the flowers. And there's a few fruits nestled in there as well, just starting to develop as well.
Oh, that's exciting. Yeah, you're going to get some seeds off those,
so
maybe.
So we'll get a few. We always get the odd one or two.
A few, that's the problem, I suppose.
Yeah, the few is the problem. But yeah, I see they're all like little green purses hanging off them. But
right.
It's a really small little shrub. Often in the wild, they're much smaller than this. They, you know, these plants are about, what, maybe 20 centimetres across, about 7-8 centimetres high. Often in the wild, they're not even half of that size.
It looks a little bit like thyme.
Yes.
Is that unreasonable?
No, the little haired green leaves, yes, would look a little bit like thyme, and it has a pink flower.
Easy to miss in the wild.
Oh, yes. Often in the wild, they're tiny. And, you know, they'd just be, you would not spot them because they're just so small. Sometimes they're just a little stem with just a few leaves, and that'll be it. So.
And when there are so few specimens, it gets even harder.
Yeah. Very restricted distribution, this plant. Only occurs near Beaconsfield. There's a few small populations. So it's really restricted. There aren't huge numbers of plants.
How many are we talking?
It varies, fluctuates with different fires. So when a fire goes through, you get a bit of recruitment. But then if the conditions get dry, they often start to fail. So they'll die off. So the numbers go up and down. So I'm not sure what the current number is, but you're talking about maybe a few hundred plants.
Yes, and just looking at the threatened species listing statement from the Tasmanian government, it's earmarked the shy Susan, or Tetrathecia gunnii, as endangered. Less than 250 individuals left, as James was saying. The principal threats: mineral exploration and mining, timber harvesting, and reproductive failure. And speaking of reproducing, James doesn't want to rely on taking cuttings of the plant because that means the new plant's going to be a genetic copy of the old one. And so that could lead to problems with susceptibility to disease.
Many years ago now, we collected material from the wild. We're trying to get more individuals as we can. We're trying to get seed, because if you propagate plants from seed, each of those seeds is a unique individual. However, germination of Tetrathecia is actually quite difficult. It's not been studied hugely. We've been trying to get seeds off these plants for a number of years now. And most cases, that's fairly straightforward. But the thing about Tetrathecia gunnii is it won't accept its own pollen. It has to be pollinated by another plant. The anthers are like little pepper pots.
This is a part of the flower.
Part of the flower. So where the pollen comes out, the little anthers, they're like little pepper pots. And the pollen won't come out unless the flower is vibrated. And that's usually done by, you know, a little native bee coming in. The flowers are pendulous, they put the face downwards. A little native bee flies underneath, comes to the flower, and vibrates the flower, and the pollen comes out. And the bee collects the pollen and flies off to another flower.
I'm going to use my imagination here for a second. I'm imagining a pepper pot upside down with its little holes pointing down, and I'm imagining just holding it still and nothing coming out.
Yeah.
But if I sort of shake it around a little bit, then the pepper will start coming out.
Yes.
In this case, that's what's going on inside this flower.
Yes.
But not just that, I have to wiggle it around at just the right rate in order for the contents to come out, the pollen.
It can be very specific. We don't know precisely if there's a set frequency for this plant, but we do know for other species of plants, it has to be a specific insect that can get the pollen out of the anthers. This is not an unusual behaviour. It does occur in a number of plant species.
Yeah, and James tells me that there's one plant in Africa that can be pollinated by just one species of bee. So in these cases, when the bee's in trouble, then the plant's in trouble too.
And this is what could be the problem with the Tetrathecus. Seed set in the wild is very low. And what could be the problem here is the actual habitat is very poor for the pollinators. And so the lack of pollinators is creating a lack of seed set. And the lack of seed set means that the amount of seeds in the soil is declining. So what happens with these plants is when a fire goes through, they'll be killed, but then the seeds will germinate. And that's fine as long as the plants are producing seeds on a regular basis. But once the seed production starts to fall, the recruitment will start to fall and the plants will just begin to decline and shrink and decline and shrink.
So with each fire that goes through, the number of seeds that spring up will be less each time?
Potentially, yes. If there's no replacement of the soil seed bank, yes.
Now, I'm kind of curious about how many other plants are in this predicament, you know, declining range, declining population. And it turns out we don't even know.
The problem is, of course, is that, you know, particularly places like Australia, Australia's hugely biodiverse. We've got a massive numbers of species of plants and animals, hugely complex ecosystems, and, you know, more work that we could ever handle in terms of trying to understand the interactions between all these different organisms. So it's not surprising that we don't really know, but I guess the worry is that we don't know the consequences of, you know, if we lose a certain type of insect or a certain type of plant, we don't know really what those knock-ons might be. For some things, it may be very minor, but for other things, it could have larger implications.
Are you ever daunted by the scale of the task and saving what could be an unknown number of threatened species out there?
You kind of just do what you can. We plod our way through, we plan trips each year and different species we're trying to deal with. I'm working for the seed bank program here. So my aim is to try and secure seed collections to act as an insurance policy. So if a population is lost in the wild, we can germinate seeds and try and restore not just that species, but the genetic diversity represented by that population.
So what are the main barriers to generating seeds for the Tetrathecia here at the gardens?
The main barrier in terms of seed production is essentially the fact that the plants have to be cross-pollinated. They will not self-pollinate. The anthers will only release pollen if they're shaken. So what that has meant in the past is that we get a little metal strip, we place it under the flower, and then we pluck the metal strip and make it vibrate. We get the pollen out.
Like a tuning fork on a piano or something.
Exactly like a tuning fork.
Yeah.
So you're putting the sort of vibrating plate underneath the flower, getting the pollen out, and then moving to another pot and applying that pollen to that flower, and then shaking the stick again, getting some pollen out, going to another plant, putting that pollen on that flower, shaking it, getting pollen out.
So how do you know when you're reapplying it back into the destination flower that it's going in properly?
The little stigma does stick out. So if I can, let's see if you can see a flower here. So you can just see, can you see that little white, very fine white hair?
Okay, so what we've got here is four mauve petals that have sort of opened out, and inside there's a darker base.
Those dark bases there, those are the actual anthers. So that's where the pollen's coming out of, yes? So I think you can see there's two, looks like there's eight anthers. And then right in the centre, there's that little white hair, and that's the stigma. So, yeah, so we have to brush that little white hair over the stick and then shake the pollen, get some more pollen out, and then go to another plant.
That is seriously delicate work, yeah.
It's delicate. It's very, very time-consuming. You know, if we had little native bees in here, it would save us a huge amount of time, and they'd be far more effective at pollinating these plants than we'd be.
Well, they've evolved especially for it. So why aren't the native bees coming in then?
We didn't know. We weren't sure. We knew we had a pollination problem several years ago.
And so James tells me that other plants in this nursery, let's say ones with larger flowers, they had no trouble attracting introduced honeybees. And so plants over there would be practically covered in these honeybees, whereas poor old shy Susan was shunned because native bees, the only ones that could actually pollinate the plant, were hardly showing up at all.
So that's why the gardeners approached the university and said, look, we recognise we have a problem here with native pollinators. We only see the odd native bee occasionally. They were very few and far between. Now, getting this sorted is really important for us. Growing plants in pots is actually quite expensive. It's quite time consuming. They're vulnerable to diseases and pest problems. So they need to be sprayed. They need to be potted. The Tetrathica is very, very problematic in culture. They can be very sensitive. So there's a lot of time and management. And each year an orchard fails to produce seeds, costs us thousands of dollars. So every year a seed orchard runs on, costs us more and more, and it costs it to take up space. So if we can't clear a bench for another project, for another seed orchard, that slows down the amount of seed orchards we can run as well. So it's really important that we get the pollinations. So when the plants flower, we get good pollination and good seed set, because it means we can do more projects, and it saves us huge amounts of time and money. So trying to get native bees occupying space in the nursery here is really important for us. It will save us huge amounts of money and make us far more productive.
James Wood at the Royal Tasmanian Botanical Gardens in Hobart. He's the seed bank coordinator there, where he's helping to secure the future of Tasmania's threatened plants. And you're listening to Off Track on RN. So what's happened to all those bees? Matthew Crawford is setting out to meet some bee hunters.
The birds and the bees are flying in the trees. The sun's in the sky, and just for you and I. The sky's perfect blue, no cloud could spoil the view.
Okay. So we're now in the small reference laboratory we have here, which we store the bees in traditional insect cabinets. And once the bees are pinned and labelled, they last for probably hundreds of years if we look after them.
And this is Dr. Peter McQuillan. He's an entomologist and he's a senior lecturer in environmental studies at the University of Tasmania. He's brought me into this bug lab, and you've got to use your imagination here. Just think of those old-fashioned museum display cases with all the insects pinned directly into them, because that's exactly what he's showing me right here.
There's probably at least 30 species in these two drawers, which is about a third of the diversity of Tasmanian native bees that we have.
So, hang on, a third of the diversity of Tasmanian species is right here. So, how many species in Tasmania of native bee?
There's something just over 100, but...
100?
100.
Just in, an island the size of Tasmania has 100 species of native bee.
And that's probably... that would only be about 5% of the continental total for the whole of Australia. So native bees are very diverse in Australia. You're looking at more than 2,000 species in total.
2,000?
Indeed.
And so where are all these bees?
Well, they're out there, but most of them are quite small and discreet, and unless you actually go actively looking for them, it's very easy to overlook them. They're mostly solitary species which nest in retreats either in the ground, in small burrows, or they may take over the abandoned burrows of boring insects in dead wood.
Okay, so solitary. So they're not having big hives with big social structures like a honeybee.
That's right. Each female rears her own brood independently. In fact, once she provisions her small nest and lays a couple of eggs, she abandons them to their fate.
Well, let's look more closely at some of these native Tasmanian species. I mean, I'm getting right down close to these now. And... they almost look like little black flies.
Indeed. In fact, they're about, most of them, on average, are small. They're about the size of a house fly or a bush fly. They're most commonly black or dark grey. A few of them are more brightly coloured with orange or reddish abdomens. But certainly, when you look at the totality of species in Tasmania, the two things that strike you is, A, they're rather dull coloured on average, and B, they're rather small. Almost all of them are smaller than a honeybee. And, in fact, the largest native bee in Tasmania is about the size of a honeybee.
All right, well, I really want to get outside and see if we can find some native bees and look at their natural habitat for a bit. But I thought I might mention that you can go to the off-track page on the RN website and see for yourself what these bees look like. What's it looking like up here?
So this is Berseria spinosa, called prickly box locally, but it's a widespread tall shrub, prickly shrub, that's common in open grassy woodlands in the dry parts of Tasmania, but it's not particularly appreciated by sheep farmers because the prickles can get into sheep wool. But its value to native bees is that it's a very profuse flowerer at the end of spring and through early summer, and it attracts a wide range of native bees and produces a lot of pollen and nectar that's very sought after.
Okay, so we've made it to the Queen's Domain. It's still pretty close to the centre of Hobart. It's just up the hill from the Royal Tasmanian Botanical Gardens, where I was talking to James Wood before, and it's one of the sites that Peter and his team are looking into as they learn more about the plight of Tasmania's native bees.
These are small native daisy called Billy Buttons, or Crespedia. Again, very attractive to native bees. It's a bright yellow flower, but with an overcast cool afternoon like this, chances for seeing any action are a small.
Well, I don't know. I can actually see my shadow now. It's, I'm feeling quite hopeful that we might spot a native bee out here.
Yes, the temperature's almost in double figures as well. That's going to be good.
Thanks, Hobart.
Okay, so this is the gear I'd normally take out in the field with me.
And here's the last person I need to introduce to you. This is Melanie Bottrell, or Mal. She's an honours student of Peter's at the University of Tasmania, and she's actually key to this whole story. A while ago, she went along to the gardens with the idea of volunteering. She thought maybe she could go out in the field as an assistant. But she ended up being given funding for her own research project. Because remember what James was saying before? They wanted to find out why, in that nursery, the benches with the shy Susan seemed to be attracting hardly any native bees. Well, Mel is trying to find out what is going on.
This is a very high-tech net with fine mesh, so the bees can't escape through the holes.
Well, it looks pretty high-tech. It's got a nice aluminium tube handle. It's,
yep.
It's flasher than what I had on primary school expeditions to wetlands to catch bugs.
Yeah. And so that makes it a lot easier to catch the bees. You can just trap them like this.
You've just put the net down over a plant.
Yes, and, so you put it down over. You often catch the bees on a flower, put it straight down on top of it, and then transfer the bee from the net into one of these containers.
Just a little plastic medicine bottle or something, and you could sort of chase the bee inside the net with the bottle until you've got it.
Pretty much. That's it. Another way of catching them is we've got these coloured pans. I'd put out sets of, got six different colours here. Black, red, white, yellow, green and blue. Now, the green was the control. Black caught nothing at all because it reflects all wavelengths. So that made sense. The most bees were caught in the blue pans, followed by white and then yellow. So these pans mimic flowers, large flowers.
I mean, not in shape. I mean, these things look like, 15 centimetre across breakfast bowls or something. So,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, they don't look like a flower in that sense. But the
No,
colour.
They don't, but to bees, they do.
So they just zero in on colour and they're just not too fussed about the shape of things?
No, because they're hovering at a distance above our head height usually. And they'll just see the colour and think, okay, that's a flower, it's a nectar source. And go straight down towards it.
Okay, so, and do you have to put anything in the bowl, or what
yes.
happens then?
So we set them out roughly half a metre apart, like so. And we've got this highly concentrated detergent, which is odour-free, so it eliminates that sort of bias. And you basically fill the bowls as close to the top as possible to prevent any native bees escaping out the sides. Leave them out in the field generally a minimum of 2 hours and then come back and see what we've got.
So what are you actually surveying for? I mean, are you doing population densities, or is it just a simple matter of identifying which native species are in any one location?
Both of those things. We're looking at both abundance and diversity of native bees at a variety of different locations. So a set of six coloured pans, leave them out for say 2 or 3 hours, transfer them into one of these containers, take them back to the bug lab and transfer them into ethanol.
Yes, by which point the bees are no longer living. But
yes, unfortunately, that's the only way that you can identify them. You can't identify them while they're still alive because the features on them, and they're so small as well, you've got to do it under a microscope.
Well, they're contributing to our understanding of their predicament at least, so...
Yes, I console myself by thinking of it that way.
Yes. And what kind of evidence do we have that native bees are in decline in Tasmania?
There's no actual scientific evidence. There's no publications that say they are rare or they are endangered. But it's just one of those things that's obvious when you go out in the field and you spend hours and hours and you can't find anything. When it's clear that they should be out, if it's a nice sunny warm day and there's lots of native plants around, there should be native bees as well. So that suggests that they are in decline.
So Peter Mal's saying that it seems that there is very likely to be a problem with native bees being in decline. What ought we to be doing to be helping native bees?
I think if we can just raise their profile a little bit so that people are appreciative of the fact that they, A, do exist, and B, that often just doing a number of small things can make a big difference to native bees. For example, just appreciating the fact that they have certain requirements for nests, and these include dead wood, whether it's standing or on the ground. So it's important to keep a certain minimum amount of dead wood in the environment. And secondly, being alert to the fact that each native bee species has a particular season when it's active, so it needs continuous access to pollen and nectar over that particular time. And that need not just be native plants necessarily. We know from Mel's work that things like dandelion on roadsides can be quite important. So a number of species of native bees are quite adaptable to local resources. But like any native insect, they're probably rather sensitive to things like pesticides and herbicides that might be used unwisely in certain circumstances. So basically making sure that these chemical sprays are targeted to where they're actually required and not allowed to drift into adjacent environments. Another positive thing that people can do is to maintain small parts of the landscape. It might be headlands or along hedgerows or fence lines that can be let go back to native vegetation because, just a small percentage of the environment maintained in its natural state can be sufficient to sustain quite respectable populations of native bees.
Okay, so did you get all of that? We can help native bees by leaving a little bit of dead wood about the place. That's good for nesting. Perhaps we could allow a little bit of land to go back to native vegetation, great food source. And we could be more careful about how we use sprays. And Peter's telling me that local councils could consider cutting back on roadside spraying. Even dandelions are a useful food source for our native bees. And if we didn't do anything, he says, well, we could end up with a situation that's been seen in other parts of the world where native pollinators have gone into a really serious decline. And back at the botanical gardens, that'd be terrible news for James Wood and Shy Susan.
What we hope to achieve with the Tetrathecia is to get good seed production, to get a good collection into the seed bank, and if I get that, then I can start doing germination studies on that. Then I can then start looking at trying to understand its longevity. So we can then start making predictions as to how robust the soil seed banks in the wild site are, and make predictions as to what the likely recruitment is going to be, and how we could possibly get better germination in those locations. If we get good seed production as well, it means that we can start looking at developing techniques to sow in situ to get better recruitment in the wild, to boost those wild populations as well. But all of this requires us to have seeds to begin with. And if we don't have the bees, we won't have the seeds, and we can't save the plant. So we need the bees.
Saving Shy Susan, needing help from our native bees, and James Wood at the Royal Tasmanian Botanical Gardens in Hobart. And Off Track today, made by Matthew Crawford. I'm Amanda Smith. Don't forget the website has pictures of Shy Susan and the bees, abc.net.au/radionational. Scroll down the program list to 04 Off Track. ABC News is coming up in a tick here on RN. A final word, though, from the people who are helping to save our poorly understood native bees. From the University of Tasmania, Peter McQuillan and Melanie Bottrell.
My hope for the future of native bees is that more research can be done on them, especially within Tasmania, because they're so poorly understood here. And with that research, hopefully we can use these strategies discussed earlier and increase their numbers, which will then hopefully help out the threatened flora in Tasmania also.
Also, I look forward to a future where native bees can actually be put to good use in support of the agricultural economy of Tasmania. So as we diversify the range of crops that we grow, often in towards high value end crops, native bees are very important as pollinators that assist the seed set of those plants. And so with the right judgment and the proper considerations given to their future, I think they can make a positive contribution to the economy of Tasmania.
When Lake Eyre flooded in 2009, thousands came to marvel at this rare event. One of the visitors was photographer Peter Elfs, who spent 4 years shooting pictures, which he has collected in the new ABC book, The Green Desert. As the lake continued to fill and its salt pan plains sprang to life, the extraordinary changes held Elfs in their grip. The Green Desert, filled with magnificent images, available now from ABC shops, centres and ABC shop online.